Get your gear ready. This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation. Welcome back to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation, a podcast dedicated to guiding you along your innovation expedition. I'm your host, Ben Tingey, joined again today by Jay Gerhardt. How are you, Jay?
Ben, I am outstanding. And I got to tell you, I'm already feeling smarter, more insightful, and world-changing just being on the line with these guys who are today's guests.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We're excited to have a pair of a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast veterans back with us today. Ifosa Ojomo is Senior Research Fellow at the Christensen Institute and co-author of The Prosperity Paradox, How Innovation Can Lift Nations Out of Poverty. Ifosa teamed up with Dr. Clayton Christensen and Karen Dillon on that great book and joined us on the podcast in episode 40 to talk about it. We also have Rich Alton, who's the Director of Emerging Research at the Christensen Institute, and he joined us in episode 58 to discuss some research on autonomous vehicles. Ifosa and Rich, welcome back to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Jay. It's good to be here. It's good to be here with Rich.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back. Ben, I'd like to take a second and give a shout out to their fabulous colleague, Christina Nunez Ross. She's director of communication at the Christensen Institute, and she connected us for this podcast. As just a reminder for our listeners, the Clayton Christensen Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank dedicated to improving the world through disruptive innovation. It was founded on the theories of the late Harvard Business School professor, Clayton Christensen. Please check out their work on christenseninstitute.org and subscribe to their newsletter. You know, the work they're doing across education, healthcare, economic prosperity, it's always been really important. But this new world that we're in, that we find ourselves in 2020, it just makes it so critical and impactful.
Yeah, I agree. And to your point, Jay, last week, Ifosa and Rich published a new research paper entitled Avoiding the Prosperity Paradox, How to Build Economic Resilience in a Post-COVID World. And we've provided the link in the show notes for our listeners. This research paper asserts that market-creating innovations are a viable path to shared prosperity, and they ultimately increase resilience to economic shocks like the one caused by the current COVID-19 pandemic. To increase the proliferation of market-creating innovations, the paper provides a three-step framework for discovering, evaluating, and developing market-creating opportunities. So there's a lot of big, important thinking that we're going to dig into today. So with that, Ifosa and Rich, are you ready to get started?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We are. Right. We're really excited to be here.
Let's jump in. Ifosa, I'll start with you. For new listeners to the podcast, or as a refresher to those who haven't listened in a while, many heard you speak about the prosperity paradox in episode 40, but could you give us a quick elevator speech recap of what is the prosperity paradox and the big idea behind the book?
So I think really at the core of the prosperity paradox is this counterintuitive idea that you actually don't get to fix poverty and create prosperity by focusing on poverty. Instead, if you focus on creating prosperity by investing in innovation, that gives you a much better shot at economic development and creating shared prosperity for all. That idea is sort of rooted in this practice in the development industry that looks at poor countries or a lot of emerging economies and says, let's go in and let's fix the visible signs of poverty. Let's fix the education system. Let's fix the governance. There's too much corruption. Let's build infrastructure, roads, bridges, and so on. Let's build institutions. And so the approach is to try to fix all these visible signs of poverty. But when you actually look at the data and progress over the last 60, 70 years, what you see is many countries that were poor 60, 70 years ago are still poor today. Now, what we propose in the prosperity paradox, and we build on that in this paper, is looking at it from an entirely different angle, a different lens, is instead of focusing on fixing poverty, what if you invest in a particular type of innovation that we call market-creating innovation? Now, market-creating innovations transform complicated and expensive products into products that are simple and affordable so that many, many, many more people in society can get access to them. When you do this, three amazing things happen. First, you create a lot of jobs for people, and jobs are very important in creating prosperity. Second, you generate new tax revenues for government so they can have more resources to build institutions and infrastructure. And third, you begin to create a culture of entrepreneurship and innovation in the society that rewards investors who put in hard-earned capital to take risk to create this new market. I'll end with just one simple example. When you look at the proliferation of mobile telephony in many parts of the world, especially emerging economies, what you find is this approach at play. Entrepreneurs and investors went in, invested in mobile telecommunications market, served a lot of people who historically did not have access. And today, what you find is these new markets are worth billions of dollars, support millions of jobs, and are generating tens of billions of dollars for governments in these countries. That's the approach we're hoping more people take in helping create prosperity around the world.
I love that, the ripple effect of market-creating innovations. And Afosa, since we last spoke, I wanted to get just a maybe as a quick aside, after you and Karen and Dr. Christensen wrote the book, what have been some of the rewarding outcomes or feedback or even initiatives that have resulted from the book?
I would say I would put those into two different categories. The first is just the messages that we have received from people who have read the book. Messages from entrepreneurs, some investors, and policymakers that are really trying to move the needle on poverty in emerging economies. They say the book gave them a new language to explain what they're trying to do. It gave them a framework to help improve some of the things that they've been trying to do for the longest time. And so that by itself is incredibly encouraging. But then the second thing that has happened since we published the book is connections to other organizations who believe in the message and want to figure out a way to amplify that message through emerging economies and through the programs that they have there. And so we're in the process of actually creating what we're calling a market creating innovation bootcamp for entrepreneurs, investors, and corporate leaders who are focused on or who are thinking about trying to develop market creating innovations. And so that's a very exciting outcome. Yeah. We'll have more information on that soon, but I don't want to give too much away.
All right. We'll have to have you back on the podcast to report on how it went. So that's great. That's great.
Yeah, that's exciting. I love that boot camp concept. That's going to really have a lot of impact. Rich, you and Chandra Iyer spoke with us, as Ben said, in episode 58 about autonomous vehicles. We also got into Tesla and AI. And your focus at the Christensen Institute has mostly been on emerging technologies that increase access and affordability. What did you find so powerful and important about the prosperity paradox, and what got your juices flowing to do this new article as a follow-up with Afosa?
I've always been an admirer of the prosperity paradox, of course, and particularly its esteemed co-author, Afosa, my colleague.
And, Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And, you know, the pandemic upended so much for all of us. Prior to COVID, I had been focusing my research on ride-hailing services and whether they would actually reach this kind of mythical point of profitability that has been a real contentious part of the conversation surrounding those companies for a while. But when COVID hit, we really began to see the impact on those businesses, and more particularly on the gig workers who were suddenly left with no income. And the more I learned about that, I saw that it resembled the impact of what a lot of workers in the informal economies in poor countries were facing as well. There's so many people throughout emerging economies that depend on this daily flow of life in order to make their living. And so whether that's, getting into an Uber vehicle or it's taking homemade goods and selling them in a market, when this daily flow of life just shuts down, it really impacts a lot of the most vulnerable workers across the globe. And so the ideas from the prosperity paradox were around how do we shore up our economies to make them more resilient in economic downturns just became all the more relevant for me.
Yeah, and that was one of the early graphs in the paper I found really interesting, is just thinking about the level of what you call the informal economy and how important it is to different economies. It's important to us here in America, but then you look at the percentages for Africa and Asia. And we're so focused on the impact of the pandemic here, but in the United States, and it's tremendous, but you look at that data and just think about what it is worldwide. It's really something else.
Yeah. And without the social safety net, the social safety nets to fall back on, and without the economic wherewithal to be able to mount a fiscal response in the US and Japan, across the EU, you've seen some of the largest fiscal stimuluses as a percentage of GDP that some of these countries have ever mounted in their history in response to any crisis. But when you think about the poorer countries in the world, not only do they have more people who are naturally not part of the formal economy and the benefits associated with that, but they have much smaller GDPs and are only able to mount a fiscal response of a much smaller percentage of that smaller GDP. So the risk is just so much higher there. So the faster we can get all of those countries to a more resilient point in their economic lives, the better off we'll all be.
I really like the word resilience that you've been using. Afosa, could you tell us what this research paper seeks to accomplish above and beyond the Prosperity Paradox book? This theme of resilience is a central focus, but how does it complement what the Prosperity Paradox provided?
Yeah, I think, there are a couple of things we wanted to highlight here. The first is that, when you create prosperity, right, whether you mean to or not, right, you solve the poverty problem. But in addition to solving the poverty problem in society, you also create a society that is more resilient, right? To use the word that we use in the paper and that Rich has been using. Solving poverty is not enough. Creating prosperity has to be the goal, because when economic crises like this happens, like this global pandemic, poor countries where the strategy has been, let's try to eradicate poverty, let's try to just get all the kids educated, let's try to build water wells, they can't really mount the kind of response that we see from more prosperous economies. And so this article sought to connect this notion of prosperity to the idea of resilience. Absolutely, absolutely critical. I think the second thing this article tried to do is provide for the readers sort of an idea of how to go after market creating innovation opportunities. If we looked at the book, it provided this conceptual framework and this idea about the power of market creating innovations, and it linked that to different components of society, how you can create jobs, how you can create wealth, how that can guide investments in infrastructure and the building of institutions in society. And so we provided some good evidence for that in the book, but we wanted to go a step further in this paper and say, okay, yeah, market creating innovation is a nice idea, but at FOLSA, I'm looking at Nigeria, for example, where, 80 or so million people are living on less than $2 a day, and the government only has $200 to spend per person a year, so they can't really build all the infrastructure, education, and all that stuff they need. The GDP per capita is somewhere around couple thousand dollars, definitely going to go down after COVID. What do you mean there is opportunity in Nigeria to create new markets? Well, we wanted to provide a framework for how to think about going after what we describe as non-consumption. And so we provide a framework in the paper that we hope is helpful.
Yeah, the framework is helpful. And to me, it almost reads like a guidebook or a playbook of almost maybe a how-to guide, I guess, of as you are analyzing the opportunity, how do you calculate that opportunity? And I imagine Rich was involved in some of the modeling, just given your background, Rich. But I thought that was really a fascinating thing to do to sort of map out the opportunity, because that begins to perk up the interests of investors and things like that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that in particular Clay Christensen had been thinking about for a long time is just, why doesn't everybody see the opportunity in disruption? What are some of those cognitive links or cognitive processes that prevent people from being able to see the opportunities to create new markets that maybe someone with more deeper training in disruption can see? And I think this, we go through an example in the paper of how to size a market, but that is based on non-consumption. And it was an interesting problem to think through. How do you size a market that's not there yet, right? You're sizing an invisible market. And there's all kinds of assumptions that go into, you know, a lot of investors' decision-making processes when they downplay the opportunity that exists in emerging economies. When you have others, like those who invested in Celtel, for example, one of the early African mobile phone operators, who saw opportunity to create billions of dollars worth of value out of a country that a lot of people thought, or out of an area where a lot of people thought that the people couldn't support a service like mobile phones. And so we wanted to provide a different lens to look at opportunity and how to think through estimating a market size if you assume that the people in emerging economies have the same jobs to be done as those in more developed economies.
Yeah, it really did take concept to action. So I think people find it really helpful, and you can see how that can kind of translate into kind of a boot camp for people who can really do it on the ground. As your paper details, the United States has a GDP per capita of nearly $63,000. Various emerging markets like Ghana, India, Laos, Pakistan, they're generally less than $3,000. But still, the United States has this tremendous disparity in terms of wealth and opportunity, even within its borders. And COVID-19, the recent societal unrest, has just shine this light on it, perhaps more than ever before. So it seems like the prosperity paradox has lessons for us here at home in the United States as well. Can each of you expand on this a little bit, maybe offer some examples, industry sectors or community challenges in which the book's lessons could actually help us back here in the United States? Rich, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So, and maybe I'll just start off with a bit of a overarching point about that, you know, disruptive opportunities they're always there, regardless of the environment that we're in, regardless of the economy, regardless of the specific issues that economy is facing, right? Wherever non-consumption exists, there's an opportunity for market-creating innovations. And I think it's interesting how the current environment is acting as a bit of a catalyst to drive adoption of certain technologies that can help be an equalizing force in some of the economic disparities, or at least some of their second order effects, right? So for example, you know, telehealth is a great one. I'm sure that that's something that you all are seeing in your business. Yep. As well. But sometimes it takes a crisis to kind of shake us out of some of the traditionalist or culturally reinforced views of the world that we have. And so I'm fascinated to see the extent to which the current crisis can really accelerate some of the disruptive trends that can expand access to things like healthcare, education, that can help be a moderating force on some of these disparities that have existed in our societies for a long time. I'm hopeful that after the crisis is over, we can kind of continue to pressure test some of the assumptions we carry with us about things like healthcare delivery, right? Why does it actually have to be done as much in person as we've always done it in the past? And does that really help those who are most vulnerable, our seniors, the poor, people who live in rural areas? and what stands in the way of a disruptive force that could be an equalizing force in society?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Rich. You know, if we look at the United States of America, the richest country in the world, you have in this country roughly 40% of Americans would need to borrow, sell something in order to be able to pay a $400 expense, sort of an emergency. So you need to pay $400. They would need to borrow or sell something. Richest country in the world, GDP per capita, as you described, $63,000, but 40% would need to do that. Now, that does not tell you what non-consumption exists in the U.S., but it's a proxy. It's a signal. It says, look, there is vast non-consumption of a lot of things going on in this country. I mean, again, in America, about a quarter of people who work in this country can't really take a day off, paid sick day, so they can, you know, manage the health of a loved one or something like that. This is the richest country in the world. And so the more, I'm glad you asked this question, because the more I even think about this research, even though we focus a lot on emerging economies, there are ways we can apply this to our own country and communities in our country. Clay used to say this thing. He said, you know, the value of a theory, a framework, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, the value of a theory is in its applicability in different spaces. Sort of, if you can apply a theory of disruption, for instance, in healthcare and in education, economic development, in your own life, right, then that's a robust theory. And I think as we think about some of the things we espouse in this paper, in the prosperity paradox, we're beginning to see, oh, wow, we can actually apply it in America to solve many of these challenges that that we're faced with. So we're hopeful that more people who are focused on economic prosperity in this country would get their hands on the paper and read it and apply it to their work.
Yeah, well, we agree. And I know last year, Ben was involved in some social innovation work we were doing. And I don't know how many copies of the book we got and distributed, but we definitely tried to spread the word there. You know, let's build upon what you were saying a little bit, roll up our sleeves a little bit and kind of talk through the framework. An individual or a family's experience with COVID-19 can really vary dramatically based on their ability to purchase or access high-quality broadband services. There's two industries in particular, and you've already talked about them, healthcare and education. They depend greatly upon this in order to deliver upon their customers' jobs to be done. If you're in one of these industries, and I'd like you each to talk about this, and you pick either one that you like, how does the paper in this framework guide you in targeting non-consumption and then enable you to consider and develop a market creating innovation? So I'm kind of asking about the application of this framework a little bit.
Yeah, maybe I can chime in, and then Rich could take off where I leave. So I'll actually use an example that we wrote about in the book. It's healthcare focused, and it's about diabetes in Mexico. It turns out that around maybe 40 or so million people believed to be living with diabetes in Mexico. Only a fraction of them, about 14 million, have been diagnosed. And of that 14 million, only maybe 25% have the diabetes under control. Just to give you an idea, in the U.S., about 60% of us have our diabetes under control. When you look at Mexico's the demographics, from GDP per capita to number of people living in poverty or below the national poverty line, it's not addressing this problem it doesn't seem like it'd be an exciting opportunity. Right? You've got about 42% of people living below the poverty line, almost 60% in informal jobs. And when we say informal jobs, really what that points to is millions and millions of people who don't have access to, you know, sort of the social safety nets, unemployment insurance, paid vacation days, and things like that. And so that's what we mean when we say people are part of the informal sector in a country. Government spending per capita is under $2,500. As a comparison, in the U.S., you know, $20,000, right? And so it's easy to look and say, wow, there's just no way we can solve this problem. It's too expensive. I don't think we could do it. But when you begin to go through the framework, you begin to uncover opportunity. The first thing is there non-consumption? Well, let's try to assess that, right? Roughly 40 million people are living with this disease. Last time I checked, diabetes is not a very comfortable disease to live with. It causes amputation, or it could lead to, amputation, blindness, just general illness, weakness, and ultimately death. It's the leading cause of suicide in many regions in Mexico. So you can see that there's enough struggle, there's enough of a problem with the disease that if you came up with a viable solution, perhaps people would entertain it. So that's the first, is identify the non-consumption. The second is, now that we've identified there's vast non-consumption, it's too expensive for people to afford existing products on the market, how do we estimate the size of the market? And what we propose is look at what the average expenditure in a country where there is widespread consumption is, right? So the U.S., for instance, would be a good example. We provide several other countries in here. And what you find is people would spend roughly 1% of their income or GDP per capita on treating their diabetes, out-of-pocket diabetes costs. When we apply that same percentage and say, okay, what if the average Mexican spent 1% of GDP per capita on treating this disease? What you find is it gives you about $100 per person per year. Remember, our market size is roughly 40 or so million people. So now you're getting a better idea of, wow, how big this market could be, because 100 times 40 million is... what's that? 4 billion, I think. Something like that. I think 4 billion. Well, one of the things we also found as we were doing the research for this is in emerging markets, because markets are less efficient than they are in more developed societies, people would spend maybe two or three times their income on average on goods and services than people in wealthier countries. And so you can actually expect the average Mexican to spend about $250 to $300 comfortably, fairly comfortably, to treat their diabetes, right? And when you do this, you begin to get an idea of how big this market is. And so what we found is that a company called Clínicas del Azúcar is actually doing this. And they've developed a business model that looked at the entire market, said there's a market opportunity here for me to take care of this. They've priced it at about $250 or so, depending on what kinds of services you want. There's a very basic service that's priced at about $150. But to hit that number, be able to charge that and be profitable, they had to develop what we call a new value network. They had to develop essentially an entire different chain of events or activities that had to happen so that they could provide the service to their customers. And so today, if you were a diabetic in Mexico and you wanted to treat the disease, you would have to go to a bunch of different specialists and a bunch of different places and pay a bunch of different people. It's just very inconvenient, time consuming, and it required you to manage a lot. Well, Clínicas del Azúcar put all this under one roof so that you go to one place, you see professionals that could take care of your eye, your feet, may help you manage your insulin, your nutrition. They put everything under one roof, leverage technology to make the process a lot more efficient, and are able to provide this service now to tens of thousands of people in the country, and they're growing like crazy. And what's interesting is since the pandemic, they've actually been growing because the government isn't able to allocate as much resources to other illnesses in the country because of their response to COVID. And so they've been growing like crazy since the pandemic began. And so what this shows is just really a different way to assess opportunity, estimate, is there a big market here that warrants this investment? And how might I develop, you know, what we call a new value network, the chain of events and activities that have to happen in order to make sure I profitably deliver this product or service. And our guess is whether it's education or healthcare or food production and processing, even housing, if we start with understanding and identifying non-consumption and how much of a struggle it is for people that are not consuming, and then we estimate, you know, how big a market this could be based on, you know, some decent numbers, and we begin to think through, oh, how might we reconstitute a business model so that we can serve these customers, we can begin to make a lot more progress at solving these problems.
Yeah, and that's a tremendous example. I think our healthcare listeners are going to be really interested in that. What it really intrigues me about the second step in your framework is it kind of has two sides to it. One, on the revenue side, it's the opportunity. It's a way of quantifying to show, yes, there's revenue out here. There's a market. There's a reason to invest in this. But the only way to get people to purchase your solution is to make it really affordable and accessible. And in innovation, we often say, you know, constraints help create innovation. So the flip side of the opportunity is also the constraint, because that'll kind of tell you the number that your business model has to hit in order to become viable. So that's just something that really interested me about that and how it leads you to step three in the process, which is developing the high value network.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll be honest in that, you know, developing the new value network is not easy. Existing value networks, which, you know, like I've said, is really the chain of activities that have to happen so that you can get your products and service to your customers, right? At each chain, if you just think, you know, I got to manufacture, I got to test, I got to do distribution, retail, service, whatever. Each chain adds value, right, to the finished product for your customer, but it also adds a cost. And so when you think about developing a new one that provides a new experience for the non-consumers, it's no easy feat. However, our hope is when you are reminded about the market that is waiting for you, if you solve this problem, then you know, our hope is that you're at the very least encouraged, right? You're at the very least encouraged that, you know, this is really hard. It's a hard problem. But if we're able to crack this nut and deliver this product or service at, you know, $100 a year, $200, whatever, we will have a big market waiting for us.
And the good news about, you know, we call this process, you know, unlocking oceans of demand. Because the market sizes for, I guess, what you would call non-consumption markets, if you can create those markets, is enormous. And the competitive advantages that you have, if you are the one to create that market, are enormous. Because you're competing against non-consumption, or nothing at all, as Clay used to tell us. So you're competitively very well positioned if you're the one to create these markets. The competition's very attractive to compete against.
You know, the other industry I threw out there was education. And, you know, we've had Michael Horn on the podcast before, and I know he's writing up and podcasting a storm right now, because what's happening is just so in the wheelhouse of what he and Clay have been talking about, that there's tremendous challenges in our school systems, but then the opportunity as well is just it's just amazing, but it's also moving so fast. I mean, the school session is about to start, so these solutions need to be here.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, just to highlight the education opportunity here in a little bit, in India, as an example, I mean, there's a company called Entry, E-N-T-R-Y, NTRI. They just raised over $3 million. They're sort of like the Udemy of India. And I think what's fascinating about this particular company is they don't just post a bunch of stuff for you to learn and better yourself, so to speak. They are making sure the content they create helps people that lack skills so they can get a job, which is a critical missing piece in many education systems today is how do we develop an education system that can help people not to just learn for learning's sake, but to be ready for a market, to get a job or to create jobs. And so, you know, watch this space because I really think education, you know, from secondary education to especially higher education is going to see a lot of change over the next several years.
And think about the non-consuming market in a place like India of people that don't have access to educational services that can advance their prospects for a job. I mean, that's a market creating innovation that would open up all kinds of opportunities for those non-consumers.
Absolutely. 400 million people in India today cannot speak English. And, you know, I say that not to say English is a superior language, but when you're not able to speak English in a country where, you know, many of the businesses, much of the business is done in English, at least especially when you're connecting with the international community, and English is sort of the language of business, then it instantly puts you at a disadvantage, right? So if you're able to speak English, you get to put yourself in a position to apply for certain jobs you may not have been able to. And so it's just really, that's just one simple example of how vast the non-consumption is in India and really many other emerging economies.
Yeah, and really just by asking yourself a few simple questions, you can really start to highlight how would I go about attacking this opportunity to reduce non-consumption. So, you know, we lay out in the paper, we talk about just identify what are the barriers that people face in getting this job to be done that they have in their lives. The four that are the most common are money, access, time, and skill. And sometimes all it takes is relieving one of those barriers in a given job to be done scenario in order to just unlock that market, right? So it might be being able to provide financing so that you relieve that affordability barrier. Or it might be, you know, delivering some sort of using online delivery in order to reduce that access barrier. So it's things like that just thinking through the simple, what are the circumstances that a person who wants to get this job done in their life face? And then thinking through what are the pain points that I would have to relieve in order to allow them to get this job done that they actually have can really illuminate really exciting business opportunities.
Agree. Oh, this has been such a great conversation. And maybe in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to maybe wind things down a little and ask a question that might be a little bit lighter. As you're preparing for this article, I know that you did extensive research, but you also do, you know, reading on your own time, and perhaps COVID has provided a little more opportunity for some reading. Could you each share something with our listeners, something that you've read lately that you've really enjoyed or have been inspired by?
Oh, man. So that's a tough one because I don't do a lot of light reading. I wish I did. I mean, the last book I read, I got a book club with a group of guys. The last book we read was The Pale Rider, talked about the 1918 Spanish flu and just the dynamics in the world, what was going on. Another one I'm reading now is China's Gilded Age. Just talks about this paradox of corruption and prosperity. I mean, you think about China, very corrupt, but also it's been the most magnificent country with regards to growth and lifting people out of poverty over the last 50 or so years, or really ever in such a short time. And so how do those two things coexist? And this author provides a brilliant analysis, which I think would support the work that we've done on corruption and innovation. Now, You know, so I'm thinking, man, I'm thinking, I don't know, nothing too light over here. Rich, help me.
You're not exactly doing beach reads, are you?
I don't know. Rich, help me out.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about one that I read. Well, sort of physically not light, a little bit more enjoyable. It was Ron Chernow's biography of Ulysses S. Grant. Which I think, you know, weighs in at, you know, somewhere in the range of 50 to 60 pounds.
Wow.
No, actually the audiobook was 48 hours. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was quite a read, but I just found Grant to be a really inspiring figure, especially in a time when, you know, a lot of us are facing setbacks, in our lives and, you know, I think the general story of him is kind of known, but I didn't realize just the depth of where his life was before he became the commanding general of the Union armies in the Civil War, which was like, he was literally a clerk in a retail store in Galena, Illinois, when the Civil War broke out. He had washed out of the army. He had failed in business venture after business venture and had gone to work in his dad's retail shop, selling leather goods in a small town called Galena, Illinois. And from there, within a matter of 4 years, he was the commander of all of the U.S. armies, all of the Union armies during the Civil War, and became president 4 years after that. And that's just a wonderfully, uniquely inspiring American story to me, that kind of with perseverance and the right opportunity, you know, it was just a really inspiring look at what can be possible, even after someone has faced a lot of adversity.
I think the theme of our conversation today has been this idea of resilience. And I think Grant embodies that in a lot of ways. Afosa, Rich, thank you so much for joining us for this engaging conversation. We value the research and analysis produced at the Clayton Christensen Institute and look forward to more, and encourage all of our listeners to dig into this research. As I mentioned before, we'll provide links to the article and the website and other types of things, other resources, so that you have access to the incredible content produced by Afosa and Rich and others. But thank you both so much for this conversation about your recent paper.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's been fun. Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much to all listening, and we will catch you later for another episode.
Best I have is when you edit, make sure I sound a lot better than Rich. That's all.
That won't be hard. That really won't be hard.
So I'll edit out every armor of yours and anything that Rich says, I'll just leave it in. So
there you go. I love that.
Do your best to act, you know, whether you're thrilled or not.
They're not going to be acting, Ben. These guys are excited to be on the podcast.
Of course they're excited here. Of course.